I actually used to write when I was very young. And in fact, my grandfather, whose name is Mansukh Lal Jhaveri, and he is the person that I dedicated the book to, was a very renowned author in India, in the Gujarati language. He was very accomplished. He wrote around 50 books, and he was in the World Book of Who's Who. And when I was a little girl, he used to come and visit us from Bombay, and I remember seeing him writing, sitting at our dining table, you know, all hours of the night. And and I also used to write as a little girl, and I lost many parts of myself early in my life, but as time went on in recovery, I believe that I regained contact with those lost parts of myself that were always there to begin with.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, you were preparing yourself for this moment. Well, I say the Creator was preparing yourself for this moment that you did when you finally did what you did.
Yes, okay. And in my professional life, I have been working as a psychotherapist for the last 10 years, primarily in my own private practice in Georgetown in Bethesda. And I have done a lot of work with addictions and recovery and family members of people who have addiction issues, as well as lots of work with relationship issues. And I also wanted to write something not as part of my work, but something that stems from my interest in my work that would help people. And so the main reason that I wrote the book was to write something that I thought would help people. And there were a lot of parts of my story and my life that are not in the book, because I only focused on what I thought would be most helpful for people, in terms of learning to come to terms with addiction and then learning how to live in sobriety.
You know, it's not a coincidence that you and I kind of think alike. I read a book, and I'm not going to say the person's name because I don't think that would be fair to him right now. But I read a book that a guy had wrote, a friend of mine, some time ago, his story, and it was very graphic. And for some reason or another, when I was reading your book, I got the sense that you didn't want to do that either. I mean, I talked about things, but I didn't want to take away from what I was feeling when I was going through what I was going through. And I noticed that when I was reading your book, the same kind of scenario was happening. If you probably saw it in mine, I talk more about what I felt and saw me doing to me, other than having to be so graphic about every detail, you know, making it sound like it was a really, I guess in the self-help group we call it a drug log. And I wanted to stay away from that and was able to do that. I noticed you were able to do that too.
Yes, I agree with that, because it's not really necessary to go into all the graphic details to get the point across. You know, it's possible to get the point across and, as you said, focus on the thoughts and feelings, because that's the internal life of the alcoholic or addict, and that's what I think people identify with the most.
Okay. Now, what I think might be helpful to our listening audience, because some reason or another, I want to believe that somebody's out there might be contemplating doing what you and Butch have done, and that is finding a way to share with other people in writing. And when you say, well, I was the death's experience, that just kind of, you didn't say the word frightened, but that's what made me think about when you had the oyster in Paris and you came back home and really got a good hard look at your life and what could happen and how quickly, and it just all flowed for you, all right? But if somebody is listening to you this morning, Dr. Smith, Dr. Anita Gaudia Smith, by the way, Gaudia is spelt, we practiced this on the way over.
Good. For those, I want to hear this.
Yeah, for those of you who are listening, Dr. Smith's Gaudia, her name Gaudia is spelled G-A-D.
Come on, man. I know you just had a birthday, but that's
H-I-A.
All right.
H-I-A. All right. Right. I just wanted to make sure I was getting it right.
And Butch is spelled B-U-T-Z.
G-A-D-H-I-A. Now, the reason that that's important is by the time we're finished and you'll want to find the book, You need to have that name to look it up. DrGaudiaSmith.com, as well as Amazon.com. But you got to have the Gaudia piece. That's a critical.
Got to be spelled correctly. That's what he is saying.
Yes, got to be spelled correctly.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, having said that, having said that, let me tell you all that haven't got the book yet that there are 20 chapters. And what we're going to do this morning is we're going to very slowly, very gradually touch on each one of them, just in terms of giving you an idea and a sense of what you have to look forward to if you purchase the book. All right, and it's just a remarkable experience I have the benefit of knowing her personally, so I've had a pleasure working with her. Matter of fact, let me tell you a little personal something about us. Hold up, let me switch gears for a minute. I met Anita, I think, like 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that.
Nine
years ago.
Yeah.
All right. Now, shortly after we met, she said, Lee, now I want you all to follow this. She said, Lee, I'm having some folks come over to my house Sunday around 11:30 or so, when I'd like you to come. And I said, well, okay, I'd be flattered and honored. So I showed up. She had a house full of people. Everybody was warm and friendly. And when I came in, she came and grabbed me by the arm. She said, I want you to come and meet my husband. He was in the kitchen, and he was preparing this food, and just everything was just glowing, and I'm all grinning and gushing. And she walks over to these people who were standing there, and she said, so-and-so, I want you to meet Lee Manley. He's a colleague of mine. And that's the first time anybody had ever called me a colleague, and I wasn't quite sure what she meant.
Are you still
when she said colleague, I thought, I don't know, elevated from a coworker.
Graduated.
I think colleague is the highest form of coworker.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a personal little story of mine that I hold very dear to my heart. That you let me be a colleague of yours, and then it's grown into a friendship. But I like that colleague thing. I tell this all the time.
Yeah, hold on to it.
Yeah, I ain't a coworker no more.
No more. I'm a colleague. If you just logged on, this is WFLO, the Flow, powered by IM4RadioDC.com. My name is Bush Jameson, along with Lee Manley Jr. and my daughter Sharina Jameson, who's sitting over in the corner chilling. Our guest this morning is Dr. Anita Smith with us. She's an author, psychotherapist, and hang tough. You want to be right here, stay right here with us, you know, and we're going to give you some more about her. We're going to take a little short break right quick, because we're going to say hi to some folks this morning before we get too far in this, but stay with us. Don't go nowhere.
All right, we got a couple of corrections to make. If you're attempting to go to Amazon.com looking for the book, you have to type in Dr. Gaudia, G-A-D-H-I-A, hyphen Smith. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right, hyphensmith.com.
Oh, that's what you said it last
So we were hyphen, talking about she reminded me of the hyphen. I mean the Gaudia, but I forgot about
the hyphen. Yeah,
on Amazon, they can just put in my name, Anita, A-N-I-T-A, and then the last name, G-A-D-H-I-A hyphen Smith.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, because I know if you miss anything,
it won't come up.
It won't come up. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we'll say that back and forth during the course of the show, but that's an important piece of information that you need to have if you want to pull this up and check the book out. All right, so speaking of the book and just getting back to the book, I'd like to, if you would, Anita, just kind of briefly just walk through the chapters as you've kind of unfolded them. And it starts, chapter one is entitled The Outsider. Now, when you say it started to flow for you, you didn't have any chapter titles. You just had life's experiences, or?
Yeah, I did not start writing from the beginning. I started writing about a particular time of my life about 10 years ago that jumped out at me first.
Okay.
And I would write about an hour a day, mm-hmm. and as time went on, that increased, and I wrote more than an hour a day, but pretty much every day, at least an hour. And I just wrote about what I was thinking about and feeling at the time, and it was not in order, and there were no chapter titles really until almost the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
I think that's usually how it happens too. When you're talking about writing something about your life, it comes as it comes, and then eventually you kind of put it together, because that's the same thing happened with me. Mm-hmm. I was trying to think in order, but it doesn't work that way.
Right. And
if you I write late at night. I don't know how you were doing it, but late at night, mine is 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and my wife would say, "You better get up," because I'd be telling her what I'm thinking. She said, "No, you better get up, because you know, and by the time in the morning you would have forgot what you was thinking about." So yeah,
all different times, mm-hmm. and it something always just flows naturally. It's best not to try to force any particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to just do what you feel and then, you know, kind of put it all together when you can.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you finally got the idea, was it very clear to you that you were going to write a book?
Yes.
Yeah, there was no doubt about that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And then it started with just whatever it is that you could remember and reflect on as it related to your personal experience with being in the profession, or being in recovery, or using, or how did it start? I mean, what part of it? You said about 10 years ago.
It started with the chapter that I called Sparkling.
Okay.
And that was a time in my life when I was not yet married. I was in recovery,
mm-hmm.
and I was really out in the world and experiencing things that I had never experienced before, met a lot of different people, and was involved in the Washington social scene as a sober person,
mm-hmm.
In a way that I had never been before. And that was just where I started.
Right.
But along the way, you know, one day I would be thinking about something from my childhood, and, you know, another day it would be something completely different. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was just blocks of information in the beginning. And the other interesting thing about it was that as I went through this process, I also got in touch with lots and lots of people from my childhood and my past. And I hadn't really planned on it, but it was kind of part of what happened along with writing it and remembering everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I made contact with people I hadn't spoken with in decades.
Hmm. Okay, and what was that like for you?
Well, that was really very, very interesting. Some of the people that I knew when I was young that I started using with when I was about 12 years old didn't have such good outcomes in their lives. And, in fact, one person died. Another person has had 5 organ transplants, 2 feet amputated, and is blind as a direct result of addiction. Another person is in recovery. And so it was really interesting to see that even though we were young, you know, everyone's life went on such different paths. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things of all was that there was a girl that I changed the names in the book, mm-hmm. to protect identity, but a character in the book who's called Melanie, I had known when I was about 11, 12 years old. After the book was published, by sheer coincidence, she contacted me after us not having had any contact for 27 years, and she didn't even know about the book. And so then I found out what had happened in her life as well, and she had gone on to marry a very famous rock star, lived in California, got deep into addiction, and did time in federal prison, and is back in this area, you know, dealing with lots of things right now.
Right. If you don't mind, I'd like you to go back to the sparkling, mm-hmm. as a recovery person with a social life. And for those that might be listening who are new in recovery, what does a social life mean when you stop using? How do you cultivate that? How were you introduced to it? How did you adjust to it?
When I first got sober, I'm sober 18 years, and when I first got sober, a social life was basically about being with other people who were sober.
Okay.
Because I felt most comfortable with them. But in this chapter, in Sparkling, that social life expanded to all kinds of other people. And it meant going to parties. It meant going to clubs. It meant going to black tie events. It meant going to museum openings and going out on dates and, you know, doing all kinds of things as a sober person. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I had been in recovery long enough that I knew how to handle myself in situations where there was alcohol present, and that was not an issue.
Okay. All right. So you felt confident that you could go any place and do anything without the fear or the threat of drinking.
Absolutely. By that time, I had traveled, you know, halfway around the world by myself, mm-hmm. As a sober person. You know, I had done lots of things, and I basically felt that I could be anywhere and do anything and be at my best, mm-hmm. and have a much better time than I ever had before.
Okay. All right. If you've just logged in, we want to welcome you to Street Masters this morning. My name is Lee Manley, along with Butch Jamerson and our trusted assistant associate sidekick, Sherry Jamerson. Our guest in the studio is Dr. Anita Gadia-Smith, and Gadia is spelled G-A-D-H-I-A. She's a psychotherapist and an author, and she's talking with us a little for her experience and her personal journey. And what I'd like you to not lose is the phone number. If you'd like to talk with Dr. Smith directly this morning, and the new number here at the studio is 301-560-6992. 301-560-6992. And if you've been following this morning, Dr. Anita is talking about a chapter called Sparkling, and Sparkling is a time and a place in her life, and I don't want you to miss this, where recovery, where sobriety affords her, now listen to this, affords her to go any place and do anything. See, that's recovery. It's not living with the fear of drinking. It's learning how to fit in society. And I just didn't want you to miss that, because I just thought that was a critical point about the recovering experience, that it's life's changing. It's not you don't drink and then you live in fear. Is that you don't drink and you learn how to adjust and adapt your life so you can fit anywhere, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Black tie, museum openings, Paris, first class airplane. You learn how to say no thank you.
Hey, Anita, how you do that? It's like being a chameleon. You walk in, you check out the area and go, okay. That's something else. Yeah. You're able to switch up anytime you feel like it.
All right. Now, let me ask you, how much can you talk about, and you remember about choosing responsibility? All right.
In choosing responsibility, that's the title of a subsequent chapter.
Mm-hmm.
The major thing that I talk about there is that I came to a point in my life where I realized that only I could be responsible for creating a life that I wanted. A lot of women especially grow up with a fantasy that, you know, you're going to, if you're pretty enough or smart enough or whatever, you can grow up and meet the right guy and everything will just, you know, fall into place and you'll live happily ever after.
Yeah, the picket fence syndrome.
And that you'll be taken care of. And mm-hmm. what this chapter is about is recognizing that I am responsible for my own life and for creating what I want in my life and for taking care of meeting my needs, whether I'm married or with someone or not.
Okay.
Big responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's part of what gets missed in this recovery,
mm-hmm.
the idea that somebody somewhere else is responsible for yourself as opposed to learning how to be responsible for yourself.
Well, you know, we are conditioned, and Lita, I like the way you put it. We are conditioned to think that way a lot of times, especially in females. I was raised by females, and I guess you saw that in the book. My father had 7 sisters, and my mother had a bunch of females. So I didn't know anything about men. And so I watched the process from my little, you know, where I was, the thing that you're talking about. And my mother and a few of the aunts kind of veered away from that type of thing and was telling me something different about how you had to stand on your own 2 feet at some point, because they were trying to drill that into me. Quite naturally, I got off course. But they were trying to drill that into me. But yeah, a lot of female, and by me having a lot of daughters myself, I kind of see that in a few of them. You know, this, I'll find Mr. Wright, who I still haven't figured out who that is yet. And you know, everything will be cool. But it just, somewhere along the line, just doesn't happen that way a lot of times, you know.
So the way that I put this into action was that I made a decision to go back to graduate school and become a professional.
Mm-hmm.
And I also made a decision to buy a home for myself.
In other words, you grabbed the reins yourself. You
exactly.
said, it's time for me to grab the reins now.
But the interesting thing that happens, and I've seen this not only with myself, but, you know, many others, is that when you do this, you attract a very different type of person to
mm-hmm.
yourself. And you then are in a position where you actually can have a partnership with someone because you first had one with yourself.
Yeah, starting home. Remember me saying, look at my daughter. My daughter's looking at me. Her and I had this conversation. You got something to say?
I'm just listening right now.
I saw that look on your face. That's the reason why I asked.
No, I mean,
we had a conversation similar to this, Dr. Smith, about a week ago?
Yes.
Yeah. And I was telling her, sometimes you have to correct your, I used the word surroundings at the time. I said, yeah, sometimes you have to correct your own surroundings if you expect to bring somebody into that space that's going to be, what you might feel like, compatible. In other words, I said, when you play in the mud, then you usually get people that play in the mud. Something like that, I said.
We attract people that are at our own level.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If we raise our own level, we raise the people that are attracted.
You raise the bar. Yeah. Mm. You raise the bar, yeah.
Our guest in the studio is Dr. Anita Gadhia-Smith, and Gadhia is spelled G-A-D-H-I-A. And I keep doing that, ladies and gentlemen, so I don't want you to miss it, because you won't be able to reach her effectively if you don't know the correct spelling of Gadhia as well as the hyphen before the word Smith. That's drgadhia-smith.com. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, there's no hyphen in the website. The website is drgadhia-smith.com.
Oh, okay. Okay.
All right.
Do that again. Do that again to make sure.
The website is drgadhia-smith.com, and that has all of my contact information as well as a link to the book on Amazon.com.
If you've just logged on, WFLO, the Flow powered by IM4 Radio, make sure you put that DC.com. That's the way to get to us. If you're having problems with that, just go to the website, www.streetmasters.com. Click on the glowing ball, and it'll bring you straight to us. We have a new phone. The phone lines are up. I'm like Lee now. I have to practice this myself. 301-560-6992 if you want to call in and talk to Dr. Smith while she's here with us in the studio. Again, that number is 301-560-6992. Okay, Lee.
All right. If you could, let's move to, regardless of the chapter number, but talk a little bit about looking at life through a straw. Do you remember any of that?
The chapter called Looking at Life Through a Straw is really about the descent into active addiction. And I chose that title as a metaphor because I was at that point in my early teens, and I was growing and developing, and I missed a lot of my growth and development because of drugs and alcohol. But that chapter is pretty much about how my use escalated and where it took me.
Okay.
The process.
Yeah.
Yeah, process.
Okay, well then, now let's go from there to baby steps. What do you remember that to be about? Baby steps.
Baby steps is after getting sober.
Okay.
Learning how to live for the very first time ever.
Mm-hmm.
And that involved learning how to do every single thing from going to bed, learning how to be around people. I mean, every single thing that a person does in the course of their life as a sober person.
Right, because it's not automatic. Learning how to take care of yourself is not automatic.
it's not automatic. And I just remember being really, you know, pretty much terrified of everything because I had never done anything sober.
Right.
And so everything was a new experience, going through all the seasons, you know, social engagements, interacting with people in a work situation. I just didn't know how to do anything at all as a sober person.
Right.
And so it really took some time, you know. It took quite a few years to take all those baby steps.
Yeah.
It's like waking up. Dr. Smith, that's like waking up going, you know, I know I've been here a long time, but who am I? That's what I felt.
Mm-hmm.
When I got clean, that's the first thing I felt. Now, you know, naturally, I know my name, birthday, you know, and look at your driver's license, you can see the big old mug there. But it was a shock. I was 30 years old. And I woke up and said, man, who are you? 23 years, it went by like, poof.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, like you, I started doing my thing when I was real young. And it was like, what happened? What happened, you know? And then, like you said, I'm learning. I still have a thing about bills coming in the mail. That's still one of those things, you know, not being responsible, right?
Are you afraid of the mail?
Yeah, I'm afraid of it. It's like the bill is short. Now, don't let me mess around and I've been late. Because I take it personal. One family member had to tell me, say, Butch, it's not personal, it's business. You know, when you don't pay certain things on a certain time, a machine, and he was talking about the computer, kicks it out, and it automatically says, they're not personally attacking you. But I used to actually feel, Lena looking at me smiling, I used to actually feel like that was a personal attack. Because I was like someone, what she was saying, I'm just discovering that you're supposed to do this.
On time. Right.
Yeah. And I've got, by that time, all my children are born, because I got three sons, too, along with all these girls. And I'm saying, who's the kid here, them or me?
How many children do you have?
Seven now.
Okay.
It was eight with Desi. It was six girls and three boys. Nine. It was six girls and three boys.
Lucky man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a partridge and a pear tree.
Yeah. But he was like, hey, what's going on here?
Right.
And when you said that just now, it clicked in me again. Because right today, I still am working through what you're saying. Now, I'll be 61 years old tomorrow. But I am still, at times, I have to remind myself, just like when I pay my note, the house note, everything, I have to remind myself that, but this is not personal. This is what you're really supposed to be doing. That's why I warn people about spoiling people, because that plus drugs usually causes a lot of problem when a person clears up and comes out of the active addiction and realize that I have no coping skills, I have no whatever it is to take to do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And it's my mother really didn't mean no harm, and I know she was trying to protect me at a certain point, but I realized right today that deep inside of me, that thing you spoke about just a minute ago is still active. It's not as active as it is, as it used to be, because I can kind of think my way through things, because I wrote a lot about that in the book. Mm-hmm. I was very dependent on people teaching me, showing me, but I would not do anything for myself until I got in recovery.
Now, when you heard Dr. Smith talking about everything being new,
yeah,
is that what you remember as well?
Yeah, because I wrote a chapter about it too. In my book I got the roller coaster ride started.
Okay.
Because when you come out of that, and I know she can bear witness to this, your mind is telling you a lot of times what an adult is supposed to do. But your feelings are saying something entirely different a lot of days.
Because the psychological and emotional growth stops at the point that the using starts.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're
pretty
much a kid.
In my case, I started when I was 12. I got sober when I was 27. And when I was 27 and I was first sober, I had the emotional development of a 12-year-old. And I felt like a 12-year-old, even though I was 27. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. The same thing. I was in a meeting one night, and my sponsor at the time helped me to understand that with a mirror. You remember Brother Jack, don't you, Lee?
Mm-hmm.
Brother Jack used to carry this little mirror around with him. He asked me to do something concerning step work. And naturally, you know how I react. I just, and my lip was all poked out. And he said, Butch, how old were you when you started using? So I told him, and he took the mirror out. He said, I want you to look at something. So he said it to me again. Dr. Smith, you're right. And I started going off again. He turned the mirror around and showed me how I look. He said, how old do you think you are right now? And I could actually see the expressions of a child on my face when he was asking me. All he was asking me to do was something to help myself. But I took offense to it, just like a child would if you asked him to take out the trash. And I took offense to it. And he showed me. He said, you're so smart that you're missing it. He said, look at your face. He said, you got your lip poked out like I asked you to go kill somebody. And it dawned on me that the emotions that you're talking about, because I was about 30 at the time, so chronologically I was, but deep inside, about 12 or 11, because that's what I was acting like.
Hmm. Okay. All right, so now we know that there's some emotional development, which is different than the being bright and intelligent.
Sure.
And that's different than living in the world without the substance that you had depended on for so long.
Mm-hmm. When I was reading her book, I kept getting the sense that here is a very intelligent young lady who, for whatever reason, she decided to use. But all I kept seeing was the intelligence. And I was wondering, because I'm like that too, and I was wondering, how come my intelligence didn't say, Butch, you don't need this?
This has nothing to do with intelligence.
That's what I try to tell a lot of people. That they say, you smart. Why did you do that to yourself? I said, oh, man. If they had it in the book and I'd have read it, I would have been, Butch, don't shoot dope. I might have considered it. But I never saw that, so I kept on going. But a lot of people do equate that. And I know you've heard that plenty of times. You mean to tell me you didn't have willpower? You went to school and you know. And I said, this ain't got nothing to do with intelligence. Not addiction.
Hmm. You sure about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
23 years proved it to me.
All right.
Yeah, proved it to me.
Our guest in the studio is Dr. Anita Gaudia-Smith, who is a psychotherapist and an author. And I understand that your book is doing exceptionally well on Amazon.com.
Yes, after the book was published, it was on 3 of Amazon's hot new bestseller lists for about 3 months. And I have had occasion to travel internationally this year and to speak to people in other places about the book as well.
Will you talk a little bit about that? What's it like to travel and promote your
book? You see that big smile on my face?
And kind of tell people.
Well, this past December, I went to Bombay, India.
Mm.
And I spoke at a treatment center there, which was a very interesting experience, and also to a number of recovery groups. And what was so striking to me was that in all of my speaking, I did probably 6 different speaking engagements there in 1 week. I only met one woman who was in recovery.
Okay.
It was all men.
Hmm.
And that told me a lot about what's happening in the culture. And that it's not quite the same as it is here.
Do you think it's a line drawn in the sand about what men should admit to or women? Because I know in the Japanese culture, or even in the Spanish culture, I remember when I first started to, when I first got certified, I remember working at a clinic on 18th and, I think it's 18th and Columbia Road. And it was for the Latino community, but I never saw any women. And then one of the counselors up there, Steve told me they don't allow their women to come in and recover. I said, what? He said, mm-mm. And that struck me when you said that just now. It kind of struck me. I said, what?
There are women with addiction and alcoholism, obviously, in India, but I think the social norms and societal pressures are such that it's harder for them to come out and seek help.
Because that was the same thing I was getting. That's the same thing that Steve was trying to tell me. He said, "Butch," he said, "you'll get it." Because I was very young at the time, and I was just venturing out, you know, trying to learn how to do this. And he said, "You'll see."
But India is growing and developing at warp speed right now, and there's a lot of economic development, a lot of changes going on over there. And my guess is that all of this is going to change within the next 10 to 20 years significantly.
Yeah.
Well, that's why this is so important. That's why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
Because the internet doesn't have any boundaries.
Yeah.
Analog radio, and I know you've done it. You be in your car, listen to some music, and once you cross a certain state line, the station kind of dies out. Well, in internet radio, it won't do that. Mm-hmm. I think you know now that internet will be in the cars in 09. Uh-huh. Matter of fact, it's some 08s now, and people will be able to listen to these shows that come through the internet radio, even in their cars in 09.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah. This doesn't have any boundaries. So people anywhere, all they got to do is be able to log on, and they can actually participate. Yeah. You know, in these shows.
Yeah, Ford already has it. It'll, yeah.
Yeah, I thought somebody said, yeah.
Yeah, Ford already has yeah. internet
in the cars.
In the models that'll be out in the fall, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, moving right along with our guest this morning, Dr. Anita Gaudia-Smith, who was talking about a therapist's personal journey. All right, you sober up for a while, and you decide to go back to school, and you go all the way through. And when you finish, you have a PhD in?
Doctor of Psychology.
Doctor of Psychology, all right. And you wanted to stay in this field?
Yes.
Because?
As a psychotherapist?
Yes.
I always wanted to do it.
Okay.
Ever since the time I was very young, mm-hmm. I remember being 5 years old and wanting to be a psychotherapist and being very fascinated by the concept. And so, as I had said earlier about accessing a lost part of myself in terms of writing again, I think I accessed another part of my early self that mm-hmm. needed. To be fulfilled.
Okay.
Yeah, Sonic, I've always been curious about the inner workings of how people think, feel.
And
I guess because I look at myself a lot too when I was little, I was always interested in how I felt about things. And I'm almost sure because, you know, I went through the ministry too for the same reason. I was always real, real curious about God and how that works. And I never got caught up in what they call the dogma part of it. I was interested in the spiritual nature, you know, this thing that makes things work, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And that's why I was so fascinated when I was reading your book, because I could kind of see that too. It's like you looking through a window going, I need to see why this works the way it works. Yeah.
And also in my professional work, I work with a lot of people who are in recovery, and I see this all the time, that they get sober and they don't know who they are, and they don't know what to do with themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, finding out who you really are is what the journey is all about. And through continuing to take constructive action, we can eventually become self-actualized.
Yeah.
And be who we were really meant to be all along.
Yeah, and that's important. And one guy told me, he said, if you can't look in that mirror and tell that guy in that glass that you love him, there's no sense in you trying to form a relationship with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mark Lyons said that to me.
Okay.
He said, you got to fall in love with the guy in the glass first. All right. He's important.
Can you talk a little bit about the revolution? What did that mean to your life? And how did that evolve?
Well, the chapter that's called Revolution is about early marriage.
We all have to laugh on that. Hey, look. I've been married 3 times. Woo!
I was 36 when I got married, and my husband's older, and we had both been alone for a very long time before we got married. And so, and we're both very, very strong personalities, so it was like a bear marrying a tiger. And there was a lot to work out when we first got married, and we had a lot of conflict and drama and anger, and all of our unresolved childhood issues came out, and it was just very messy. And we both hung in there and did our own work on ourselves, mm-hmm. and, you know, got through some of the things that we needed to get through.
Right.
And it was truly revolutionary for both of us because neither one of us had really been able to make it work with anybody before.
Okay. Yeah, see, again, the more I keep trying to understand what recovery is, the more it sounds like it's a way of life.
Yeah.
That there are issues and things that you have to work through. Some of them are painless, but most of them are not.
Mm-mm.
And I think most people are afraid of pain, all right, which kicks into this word called denial. And you kind of want to live in your head instead of your heart. And it's this vicious cycle of being unhappy. So instead of looking to grow up, you look for people to blame.
Yeah, and it's just like when Dr. Smith said something about waking up sober. You wake up sober, and then you begin to have all these feelings that you're not familiar with. Then some people run to religion, which is okay, but if you go there for the wrong reasons, you wind up with the same results. Because sooner or later, those feelings, those unresolved issues that you were talking about, they're going to show up.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to show up because they're supposed to show up, and it's painful. So we use a lot of different things. I've seen it in the religious arena. I mean, it runs rampant, and my daughter can bear witness to that because she's studying to be an evangelist. So Sherry sees it all the time too.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we try to take God and stuff him on top of all this stuff, and then wonder why it's not working. Because deep down, and she said it deep down, there's that emotional kid still trying to say, hey, I need some attention. I need some attention. And, you know, at that point, you're kind of going crazy. That's why I said early recovery can be real ticklish, especially when you're in a marriage, because I went through that too.
Yeah. In the beginning, when there was all of this anger and all of this hurt and all of this stuff. Well, if you could, with no gory details, when you say, well, we had to do the work, I'm not sure that everybody understands
what you mean by work.
What's the work that you did?
Well, apart from don't drink, don't kill yourself, and don't kill the other person.
Okay. Don't worry. Let's start there.
Those are the most important things.
Let's start there.
Don't kill.
The work meant going to recovery groups, individual therapy, and reading and learning and connecting with other people who were also married and constructing supports for not only the relationship but for ourselves individually.
Okay, yeah, because it sounds very difficult to go to bed mad and wake up mad and live with tension and then go to work and try to pretend that you're okay.
That you're okay.
Say, well, how you doing today? Fine.
Right.
And then you don't want to go home at the end of the work day. And again, this is life as you know it to be. So you're faced with, well, how do I deal with this today? What am I open to? And one of the things that kind of, a friend of mine passed on to me some years ago. He said, Lee, what are you willing to give up to get what you want?
Makes sense.
You know, and oftentimes I'm not willing to give up being right.
Right, yeah. Just want to be right.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to be happy. I want to be right.
All right. So you've identified your husband as being the older man and making the adjustments there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, childlessness and fulfillment, how did that kind of evolve in your life?
Well, in the book, and again, the title of the book is From Addiction to Recovery, the chapter about childlessness and fulfillment is about the fact that I never wanted to have my own children. And then I came to a point in my early 40s where I knew the option was going to be taken away for biological reasons. And I had to come right up against the issue and really confront it psychologically and work through the grief around it. And anytime you make a choice, there's grief either way.
Okay.
Anytime you make a choice, you grieve the roads not taken.
Mm.
So even though I never wanted to give birth to a baby, I still had to grieve the fact that I didn't.
Okay.
So that was part of it. But most importantly, the point is that there are many, many ways to nurture people and to give back to the world, and that there are many ways to be fulfilled. And for myself, I found through my work and also through writing ways that satisfy the nurturing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, the maternal instinct in you to be a mother.
The maternal and nurturing instinct. And I feel like I have, you know, hundreds of children, my patients, you know, are all people that I can help and nurture and contribute to their development. And so my point is that it doesn't have to be one way for okay. everybody, yeah. that we all find our way. Yeah. And what's important is that we look for our way.
Now, I found my way through having children. I know you saw that in the book.
Yeah.
When ever since I can remember, I'm going all the way back to about 6 years old, I always wanted a lot of kids because I was alone. You know, I'm an only child.
I'm an only child, too.
Yeah, and I'm an only child, and I was always alone. So my thing was, when I grow up, I want to have as many kids as I mean, I should have been careful what I asked for, but I wanted to have as many kids. I didn't care if it was girls, boy. I wanted to have a crew. Now, right now, it was 23 grandchildren, Sherry. Yeah, 23 grandchildren and four great-grand or five. I'm you know, but I wanted that. I actually did. I really did, man, for the same reason that she's talking about, and sometimes I wonder. Man, we had a party. Man, I got to tell you a little story. We had a party one time in my backyard when I was living in Orlando. And everybody, it was one of the kids' birthdays. And in that backyard, I don't think there was any friends back there at all. This was all cousins, first cousins. I mean, somebody asked me, says, is anybody friending each other back there? I said, no, I don't think so. The yard was full. And everybody back there was family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all is true.
All right. You got so many kids and grandkids and great grandkids. You need a program.
No joke.
Yeah. All right.
Look at Sherry.
Moving right along. If you've just logged on with us, you have the distinct pleasure of joining Dr. Anita Gaudia-Smith as she talks with us about her being a therapist and her personal journey through active addiction into active recovery. And one of the things we want to stay mindful, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, one of the things you want to stay mindful of is that you're more than welcome to give us a call. The new studio number is 301-560-6992. That's the new number here at the station, 301-560-6992. And to talk to Dr. Smith directly, ask her any questions about her personal journey from addiction to recovery, or about her book. And she's written a wonderful book called From Addiction to Recovery. And this is from like a professional standpoint as much as it is the personal side of her life. The idea is, what's it like for a therapist?
Yeah, I don't mean to cut you off. Yeah, I just happened to look up and see the toll-free number up above on the wall. Sorry, Lee. Because we needed to get that out. That's why I was touching you.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off. Toll-free number is 1-866-856-5903. Yeah, Lee, I did the same thing.
Did you get that?
Yeah, toll-free number, 866-856-5903. Lee, I'm sorry. That's why I was touching you. I didn't mean to cut into you.
Right. All right. Moving right along with our guest this morning. Now, I'm interested in hearing or learning a little bit about trading role-playing for reality.
Well,
talk a little bit about that.
This is one of the most important chapters in the book. Trading role-playing for reality is really about authenticity and the fact that in our culture and society, we are trained to kind of follow a mold in some ways. And I think this applies to men and women, but particularly for women as well. That what's so important is to not play a role, but be who we really are. And that means that we don't have to look a certain way, we don't have to play a certain part, and we get to love ourselves for what we really are.
Dr. Smart, real quick, do you think, I mean, I don't want to say thing. Do you feel that this is one of the reasons why our divorce rate is so high, because of this role playing we get into? Because it's almost like a competition. If you got to be a certain way, we wind up competing more in our relationships than we do enjoying the company of our partners. I've seen that over the years. I don't know if you noticed it or not. I don't want to culturalize this, but I've been seeing it in a lot of marriages where they wind up. Now, all of us go through changes. I mean, you know, we have our good days or bad days, whatever you want to call them. But I've been noticing, and I just grabbed that when you said it just now, we're set to, you're supposed to be a certain way, I'm supposed to be a certain way. And then it's, I went through that in my second marriage. That's why I brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious about what you think about that.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And you know, a lot of people not only get married for the wrong reasons, but have children for the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. not because they really want them, but because they think they're supposed to. And, you know, it's like a checklist. I have to do this because I'm this age. I have to do that, that, and the other thing. And this is kind of playing a part or playing a role.
Okay. So that's why that chapter, yeah, I see why that chapter is so important. Yeah, you pointed that out.
Right, so
and I also talk about plastic surgery and, you know, the role, the increasing role that that's playing in our society and
right.
how that's part of the whole issue.
Okay. Now, when you're trading in reality for role playing, how does that fit in your recovery thinking?
It's not possible to be who you really are if you're not sober.
That was real simple, Lee.
So being sober allows you to get to the point where you can actually think about these things and ask the questions, what do I really want in my life? Who am I really in my life? What do I want to create? What do I want to contribute? You know, am I living a life that I think I'm supposed to be living, or am I really
just existing?
Yeah.
Yeah, in a sense. Yeah.
Okay. So you were able to work this out. Was it possible at all once you realized that you were role playing and you made a conscious decision that you didn't want to live like that, the resources and the process that you used, how did that unfold for you? I mean, was it like, well, just being a wife and cooking and having babies and all that kind of stuff, that's the role, but your reality was what?
My reality was that I did want to be married. I didn't want to have babies. I didn't want to stay home. I wanted to have my own practice.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to contribute to the world. I wanted to have meaning in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the areas that I worked on in my life, but it's different for everybody.
Right. But talk a little bit about when you say that you worked on. For our listening audience, for the women that are listening to you that don't quite know what worked on means, give them an idea of what you did when you worked on your own reality.
I tried on different roles and different selves, and I found out who I wasn't.
Okay.
And each okay. one of those brought me closer to who I was.
Yeah. Okay.
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 And this is a process that took many, many years.
Okay.
Now, Lee, you remember, I don't know what chapter in my book that is, but self-discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read about that too.
Uh-huh.
In my book, self-discovery, you start to touch, feel, and see what fits, see what doesn't fit. Because
mm-hmm.
I did the same thing. I had a lot of talents like you. I was born with a lot of talents because by the age of 12, I was playing music professionally. And a whole lot of things. I was singing and doing a lot of things. But when I came out of the fog, it was all over again. I had to touch, see. And then I found out that I had other things that I had never even dreamed I could do.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of scary. That's what I was going to ask you. Because some of the things I do now, well, it doesn't scare me now, but when I started to venture off into them, I started wondering to myself, and I'm asking you that now, Doctor, did you ever somewhere in that process say, am I really supposed to be doing this to yourself? I mean, some of the things that you've discovered about you in this process.
Absolutely. But all of that was in early, mostly in the first 10 years of recovery.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious. Yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time doing things. I worked in jobs that didn't really fit me. You know, I did different things. And along the way, each time through the pain, I got closer to where I was really supposed to be going.
So you're saying adversity became a friend?
Yes.
And it started bringing you success. Every time you had an adverse, I mean, well, you know what I mean, adversity kind of pushed you a little bit, so you begin to discover that, oh, I'm on top of something.
And like Lee said earlier, it's not that we're not going to have pain in recovery. Pain is part of the process. Mm-hmm. And my experience has been that it's usually the most painful experiences that reap the greatest benefits. If I stay sober and keep taking constructive actions for myself, that's the key, to not get immobilized and stuck in the pain, but keep on taking those actions. And doing the work can mean talking to people. It can mean seeking professional help. It can mean writing. It can mean trying new experiences. It basically means working through what I'm feeling and working through new actions.
You know, I watched my father's sisters, who most of them lived to be in their 90s, and I used to always wonder, Dr. Smith, why these older folk were so cool when all hell would be breaking loose. And you just described it again. They knew who they were. Mm-hmm. My Aunt Mary, she died about last year. She's been dead a little over a year now. And she used to always tell me, Aunt Mary, she had this one that had 27 different operations, a whole lot of stuff. And I used to talk to her, and you know, she used to say, oh, baby, don't worry about it. It's only temporary. I mean, I said, don't this bop? She said, no. She said, I know this is going to pass. She said, son, you got to realize I've been here a while. She said, I've grown through some things. She said, I'm just glad to be alive. She said, I'm glad I'm looking in your face, boy. She said, you know. And I used to always wonder, how can they be so cool? You know, I'm anxiety ridden and some more stuff. And they just taking it, just, like you said, they just cruising on through. But like you said, she, in that process, she realized who she really was.
Mm-hmm. And they understand what matters and what doesn't. And I think we get that also in recovery. As a result of having been through our own prison and war and all of that.
In other words, needs versus what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, knowing what your needs really are.
Yeah. Let me just back up for the benefit of those that are logged in with us this morning that you might have missed. Dr. Smith said that some of this personal discovery, if you have a job that doesn't suit you, that doesn't fulfill you, all right. Which is that sense of awareness. It's not that the boss is mean. It's that you don't get anything from what you're doing, and you're trapped when you convince yourself that you got to pay the bills. So what you're doing is you're keeping yourself miserable, as opposed to expanding your horizons. Which is another chapter in the book that I'd like to move to, is talk about how you expand. Or expanding your horizons, because it's an ongoing process, isn't it?
Yes. And expanding horizons is the last chapter in the book, and it sort of ties in, it wraps everything up. But the point of it is that my possibilities for contributing are increasing.
Excuse us, ladies and gentlemen. We had some noise in the background. Sorry about that.
Can you get that out?
Okay. Sorry about that. I'm sorry. So you were talking about expanding your horizons.
Yes, it ties in all the chapters. And my point is that the possibilities to contribute at higher and higher levels continue to unfold.
Yeah.
And that there's no limit to how much we can grow, to what we can be, and to what we can do.
Right. Well, if you would, try to talk a little bit to the women who are listening about when you go back to the role play and the stereotypes and keep give them a little more idea of how you got through yours. Because, see, I think the beauty of what you're doing, separate and apart from the book, is being able to verbalize just what it takes for your life to be successful.
Yeah.
And based on what we know about societal norms and stresses and the pressures, I don't know that a lot of people believe that you can actually live as good as you're living based on how you set up your network.
And the thing I'm impressed with right now is that through this whole conversation, you have not mentioned once that the material things, the outer things that make people ordinarily would say, well, if I had a bigger car, a bigger house, or more money in the bank, that's what makes me happy. You have not mentioned that yet, and I think that's where Lee's going. That we're talking about a spiritual condition here. That's what it sounds to me. You're
well, it's interesting. It's interesting that you bring that up, because in my life, I have had some material success, mm-hmm. and I would say that, you know, a lot of the things that I wanted, I was able to actually get and achieve. And the irony is that once you get those things, you realize that they weren't what you really wanted. Okay. But you have to get them to realize that they're not the answer.
They're not the answer. Okay. Because a lot of people kind of spin themselves or well, and you hear it all the time. And people in early recovery do it real fast. It's like getting a payday that they never had before. And they start buying a lot of things. And then you start noticing the when adversity show up or the storms of life show up.
Mm-hmm. And money is a very important thing. I mean, we all need money in order to live and have freedom and take care of ourselves. And we all need a certain amount of money. But we don't need an endless amount of anything. Okay. You know, we don't need an endless amount of money, an mm-hmm. endless amount of sex. We don't need an endless amount of drugs or alcohol. We don't need an endless number of cars. You know, we need a certain amount, and we can enjoy it. But then the real work is to give back and leave some kind of contribution here for other people.
Okay.
And if we can use our prosperity to give back to others, then we're really living
You're
well.
Living well, okay.
Yeah.
If you just joined us, this is WFLO, the Flow, powered by IM4 Radio.